Greetings and welcome to the Reasoning with an Optimist podcast for the week of January 10, 2016. This is Jack Breshead Mills. Very happy to have talked with my friend Bill this week. But first, the verses that I wrote for Rudolf Steiner's Calendar of the Soul verses for his week 41. This one I wrote 2 years ago. Verse 41. The power of art in me, the will to create, is surging in my soul, seeking to unite with the skills I now possess to sculpt the world, a life of beauty, worthy of all my love and effort. And this one I wrote last year for the same Rudolf Steiner verse. Verse 41a. An innate force in me bursts upward with love, a blessing from the gods, surely, since it shapes my soul, crafting me for the good, forming my usefulness, making me feel at home in service. Yeah, Bill and I talked just after Christmas, and here you go. Thank you, Bill.
No, I'm not much of a historian, really. I've read a book recently on 1920s America, and it seems like we are slightly improved from that. At least the public awareness of inequalities. At that time, apparently, the Ku Klux Klan could have Christmas gatherings on corners in Detroit and have crosses burning in public, and people would come and put money in their buckets. And
in the north in Detroit.
In the north in Detroit in the 20s. And so you think perhaps we have come a little bit ahead of that.
It almost seems like an evolution in a country. I think it goes without saying it's not linear, but it seems to grow in tentacles. Sometimes some of them grow up and others grow down. And so there are much more civil rights, and yet something called freedom of speech is allowed, all kinds of really negative things to be part of public discourse. And mostly, people don't trust any of it.
I wonder if we agree that there is something called learning and progress. You know, someone who is sitting with their gun, saying, God damn it, I want to go back to the way it used to be, which is great for me, my white self, whatever. They don't even realize they're talking about a racist standpoint of how it used to be great. Mm-hmm. I didn't have to care about you, mm-hmm. you lesser people. I used to be the king, and now I'm having to care what I say around you. I hate it. And so for them, progress is not what you and I call progress. For you and I, you and me, we might say progress is everyone's welcome. So how do you even equate learning? How can you even say a society is progressing if the people themselves won't even agree what learning is and what progress is? Because many, many people think we're going backwards when you and I would say we're going forwards.
And it seems like people have sorted themselves out into different communities. People gravitate. Like, a lot of us moved to Austin for a certain reason, but we might not move to Houston.
Yeah, definitely.
Or Dallas.
Definitely.
And other people go in other directions. So it seems that while there's progress, there's also more polarization. And kind of completely different ways of looking at things, where growing up, it seemed to me most people in my neighborhood had a similar way of looking at things. It may have been, you know, antiquated from our current point of view, but they felt they were, you know, all part of a neighborhood. in a similar way of looking at things, and that's changed drastically, it seems.
Maybe that was more segregation then. Who knows?
That, yeah.
I mean, we tend to want to be segregated, at least economically. I mean, I can't move next to rich people, even if I wanted to.
Yeah. And people would worry about their property values if lots of unkempt housing moved around their house. So.
In the 20s, apparently, the Italians were the scourge of the nation. Everyone was afraid of them.
Uh-huh.
I was watching...
quaint.
I was watching It's a Wonderful Life again, and the fact that he helped the Martini family to get a house, and when they went to honor them into their new house, all these children and the goat, and the, that was brilliant at the time to show how that George Bailey was so egalitarian to allow contact with these dirty people.
Inclusiveness of the times.
Say it again, yeah.
My father remembers, as an Irishman,
yeah,
signs in shop windows.
No Irish.
Irish need not apply.
Yeah.
Which, it's that, and the Italian thing is so quaint today. It's,
I told Owen that this book talked about this, was it eugenics? That was big and popular all over the world in the 20s. And the highest race on earth, according to them, was the Nordic. And what Nordic meant was Northern European except the Irish. And I asked him, what is that? How come they were excluded? What's wrong with the Irish? But apparently, everyone agreed, oh no, you can't have Irish.
They were the primitives, kind of like the aboriginals.
No, I don't understand
Europe.
Why we change these ideas.
Celtic.
Anyway, I'm hoping we've progressed a little. I wanted to ask you, though, about this idea of teaching. I've tried to be a teacher, and you've supposedly been a teacher all your life. But I've never felt that I was teaching. I've always felt that people want to learn, and then they learn, and I want to learn, and I learn. But whether or not you are able to teach me something, I don't know how that works. I have no idea how to teach anybody anything.
I think that's totally different picture depending upon the age of the person.
Good. Please explain that.
Well,
what do you mean by that?
I think what you're describing is much more a picture of how you would have to think with older human beings.
Yes.
With the younger ones, you're bathing them in experiences.
Very good.
And so... when you hear that in Waldorf education you don't teach reading till third grade, it's completely false, because you're actually beginning a language, a rich language environment in kindergarten, where they're hearing language as it evolved from an oral experience, from a pictorial experience, so a musical experience, so poetry, rhythm. And today, most... literacy is focused on the eye as opposed to the ear. You don't hear recitation.
Yes.
The only poetry I ever studied in public school was in high school, and it was analysis. You would read a poem and you would try to understand what it meant, because poets were always obscure.
Yep. Take it apart.
Right?
Yeah.
But a first grader can recite Shakespeare. Because they can delight in the rhythm and the musicality of it, the beauty of words, even if it isn't completely understood. So you start with this oral experience, and you're always bringing something to their soul life, and you're not worried so much about outcomes in the earliest experiences, certainly in the kindergarten. And then you begin to some extent in first grade, where you have a review the next day. It's the first time you draw on memory consciously. But still you're giving them experiences, and you go from the oral to the pictorial. So they'll hear a story, and then they'll sleep on that image, and then the next day you might draw a picture of two mountains, or of a raven. And then, as Steiner pictured it, you go from that imagination to the drawing, to a kind of drawing writing. So from the raven you might find the letter R, but still you bathe them in this feeling of R. So you have a little poem, raven, raven, ride the sky, nice. Ramble, ramble, round so high, nice. Rush to roost up in the tree and rattle your rough notes, 1, 2, 3.
And maybe they're even moving around.
Yeah, so there's movement with the poetry. And it's very much an alive experience. And then you move from the picture to a kind of drawing writing, big R.
Oh, yes.
And then gradually bring it down. At first, all the capitals, which have this kind of archetypal quality, yes, to them. There's still a remnant of the hieroglyph,
yeah,
there. If you look at B,
yeah,
the W, still, yes, has the wave in,
yes,
it.
Yes, yes, yes.
And if you look at one-syllable words, sometimes with consonants, you begin to feel a quality like big, ball, bulge, bathtub. A lot of body parts, yes, that have that bulge quality. And then, so you're trying to help them have a deep experience of the genius of language.
Yes.
That goes semi-consciously, yes, yes, into them. They won't necessarily, and so of course they would never articulate it that way, but they will have a sense for that on a deeper level. And then you move from that drawing into more writing, still connected to the imagination and stories and pictures. And the last skill is spelling.
And that's introduced first grade, maybe first
grade? Yeah, you don't test it in first grade.
They want to know, of course. Some of them,
yeah,
want to,
they
know,
want to spell it correctly. But it's not your first experience. And spelling,
yeah,
only in the English language evolved much later.
Yeah.
I mean, it's professors who created, yes, standardized spelling.
Yes.
Shakespeare spelled his name, yeah, more than one way. And eventually it's the pedagogues or the pedantic people who just say it has to be spelled, and now people will judge you,
yep,
immediately if,
yep,
your spelling is off, and they'll make surmises about your education in general.
That's so beautiful. When I sit back and imagine a scientist devising a method of teaching young people how to write or to read, you would assemble the children and you would show them this is a word, these are letters, and they mean this, and this is how you spell it, and now I would like you to repeat it. You know, this,
yeah,
that would be teaching, and it wouldn't work.
Yeah, well, I mean, eventually you can make it work, but it you lose a lot on a soul,
yeah,
level,
yeah,
it seems to me. You lose a connection.
Yeah, you have to somehow give up. As a human, as a child human, you would have to somehow give up and go along with it. You wouldn't just be swept along with it. You wouldn't be carried along and learn without even knowing,
yeah,
what's happening, but you would... Okay, I'll do what he says in order to get my freedom or my food. You know, I will have to submit. You're right, I was thinking of an adult when I was thinking of how do you teach someone, but through imitation and through... I've always felt that you learn more... When I think back of my early years and what I remember of my teachers, I remember the teachers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember anything they taught.
Mm-hmm.
And so the being in front of you is the most important thing. It,
yeah.
How they live, how they act, will either make me inspired and want to become an adult, or will make me shun the idea. I'll never be old. Those two things are reactions to adults.
Yeah, and I was just reading a New York Times article in which there's a school district trying to mitigate some of the pressures kids are under, and a report of one fourth grader who had anxiety about whether he'd ever have anything to put on his resume.
Fourth
this
grade.
Is in fourth grade.
Yeah.
But it happens. And so hopefully you're working through bathing them in these experiences to gradually helping them build a sense of initiative to become an adult who does more of what you described.
Mm-hmm.
I decide I want to learn something,
yeah,
and I am going to take the initiative. and make the gesture to draw, you know, understanding out of this as you get older.
I saw a news report of a factory worker whose assembly line job was eliminated at a factory, and a seemingly normal 30-year-old woman who was crying that she was too old to learn anything else, and she's out of her job. And I think that has to do with this feeling you get from the adults around you that they seem to be constantly learning things, and I can do that. That idea that I can do that,
mm-hmm.
I think that comes from seeing teachers who are not just the same way all the time.
Yeah.
They're constantly.
Yeah. Well, that's often what a lot of students in the internal leaving ceremony will say, that they feel like they can do anything.
12th or 8th or
12th grade.
12th grade.
Because, you know, before the public graduation, yeah, there's an internal.
Oh, okay.
And that's often what you hear from.
Nice.
Students. Of course, human beings have a way of narrowing our focus as we make choices through life, but that sense that you are inwardly equipped for what may come seems important. I didn't feel that when I graduated from high school, for sure, or college at all.
Or it takes work to get to that point.
Yeah. And, do you know Robert Bly talks about this?
Yes, yes.
Sibling society?
No.
It's this picture of how once we looked vertically to the elders for guidance.
Okay.
And then generally, post-World War II, 60s, people started to look more to their peers for guidance. Or maybe slightly older ones, where, you know, people were looking to rock stars in the 60s.
Yeah.
And they were born early 40s, and the ones looking to them were born, you know,
yeah,
early 50s.
Yeah.
But still looking for guidance in your own slice of,
yes,
of age, your own age bracket, as opposed to looking at the wisdom of elders. And we don't do that in this society.
Nope.
Anymore.
Nope.
Not the way it
not
was.
Not directly,
also.
Anyway. I don't know anything about how we... I read a lot of history, and even ancient, how old humanity is, in a million years maybe. How could we possibly be changing in 100 years? When you look at the state of the country 100 years ago and how horrible it was for racial relations. New York Times could easily have the N-word anywhere. Totally okay.
Yeah, it was in the New York Times.
Yeah, comics, anything. This book about the 20s was eye-opening to me to see these horrible changes. But maybe that's just superficial. Maybe we're still exactly the same way, but now we're not saying it anymore.
I think there are more people at least aware of fairness, maybe for lack of a better word, where it wasn't even thought about. It just, you had a more of a tribal kind of consciousness,
yep,
right? All early slavery was tribal.
Yep.
You had a name for your own people and everybody else was the,
yep,
other.
Yep. I tend toward depression, and so I'm working at it all the time.
I'm in the same. I can go in that other direction.
And I see that you also have this little bit of a smile all the time, and I've really been cultivating that because it does help my mood to have a little smile.
Yeah, it does. I used to actually consciously stand at the door of a classroom and say, I am going to walk in with a smile.
Nice.
It was not my native,
yeah,
gesture. It's more, okay, I'm going to just hunker down and
that's
do something.
Nice.
But it was important.
Of course it's important to the kids, but it helps you to have a better day somehow. And then they have a better day because you're having,
yeah,
a better day.
Yeah. But I don't... People have different trajectories, but, you know, I can remember the time in college age, coming to rock bottom and feeling nothing matters. There is nothing. Total existential moment.
You can totally feel that. And nothing's going to stop you from feeling that.
Yeah, and there's nothing. But that, I think, is the one side of what Steiner calls consciousness soul. It's consciousness soul experience without a sense for something beyond. It's just this loss of all the religion, the everything in your heritage, and just looking at the void, which the Buddhists do quite happily.
Yes.
And it's a platform for moving forward spiritually.
Yeah.
But in the West, it's Jean-Paul Sartre. It's and his first book was Nausea. So he would have this feeling that other people being happy just made him nauseous.
Yes.
I never experienced that, but it was, how can you be happy?
Yes.
The world is filled with pain.
Yes, yes.
And somehow you have to start there. Some of us have to start there and climb up from that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and say, okay, the world isn't just pretty, easy, happy. And what am I going to do about it? I can either be defeated or I can find a way to meet that.
Yeah, I'll stop it there. We had quite a lot more to say, but different subjects. I think that's enough. Thank you very much for listening. If you'd like to leave a comment, go to my website, reasoningwithanoptimist.net, and drop me a line. This is Jack Bressett Mills. Bye-bye.